So good morning. I'm a theoretical physicist with a long-standing interest in morphogenesis. And I will discuss some theoretical approaches to the dynamics of epithelia this morning. And these examples are motivated by the morphogenesis of the fly. And Irvine had already introduced this system to you earlier this week. Most of what I'm going to discuss is about the fly wing. And the precursor of the adult wing grows inside the larvae of the fly, the so-called wing imaginal disc. And it grows about 5 days, 10 rounds, self-division for about 50,000 cells. And as Ken has also shown already, this dynamics of this growing epithelium can now be studied looking at culture. Wing discs, where one can see the dynamic process under the microscope, cell divisions, and also cell rearrangements.
And is the change in area, Frank, is that a real phenomenon, or are we just seeing a
so
projection?
When you say this is a projection, of course, in a plane, but when you say change in area, you may refer to this cell area changes. I'm not sure what
you mean. Yeah, the area per cell looks tiny in the sort of 3/4 of the way down, and it's much bigger.
There are some patterns of cell area which are real, yeah, which I allude to further into my. At later times inside the pupa, when there is also dramatic reorganization of the tissue, which sort of leads to the final shape of the fly wing. And of course, I skipped over in these two examples the inversion process. That happens early in the pupil stage, revealing the, sort of this extraordinary dynamics of this tissue. Now, the general interest for research is to understand how size and shape of such a tissue emerge in a very complex dynamic process. I show you an example of a misshaped wing, where a dumpy. The gene is mutant and normal wing shape, and we've recently shown that this is related to a change in mechanical boundary conditions of the tissue. So tissue mechanics is important for the shape. Now my plan for this morning is two parts. I want to first talk about the physics of tissue remodeling, the material properties of tissue, rearrangements of cells, and the physics of such processes. And the second part is about, so this is in some sense related to shape. This remodeling usually is related to deformations of the tissue and shape changes. And the second part is about size, about growth, and about how growth can be self-organized using the morphogens as growth factors and growth stimulants. So let's start with the first part. And this is work of collaboration in Dresden. This is long-standing collaboration with the group of Suzanne Eaton. And Suzanne tragically died recently. She was an outstanding scientist, an inspiring colleague, and a dear friend. Here you see people involved. I'd like to highlight Marco, Matthias, and Joris. And on the experimental side, Natalie, also Raphael. We also collaborate with Guillaume Salbreu and with Manda. So the general theme here is to understand a tissue as a dynamic system where chemical patterning processes and regulation go hand in hand with active material and active properties and active mechanical events. So we have cell division, cell extrusions, we have cell force generation, so an active material, and the paradigm for shaping of the epithelium is a mechanochemical integration, self-organization, where force-generating processes, which are regulated by chemical signals, depend on each other in this sort of tight integration. So we call this mechanochemical self-organization. Chemical signals like, for example, morphogen gradients, but also local cell signaling, but also vectorial and tensorial signals, such as polarity. Now, in this first part of my talk, I will focus on the view of tissues electric materials, and I will discuss the biophysics of these tissues. So I will just be interested in how tissue deformations emerge, in particular related to cellular processes, so to bridge scales from cellular events to tissue deformations. I will highlight that these are active viscoelastic materials that we can understand using continuum approaches, discrete and continuum approaches. And I want to discuss the idea of active and passive cell rearrangements. So in order to approach this problem, we use segmentations of these movies where we can track positions and shapes of the individual cells in this process. So we have a big database with all of this information that can be extracted and explored. Here you see that we can label individual cells. We have the identity. We track them from frame to frame. We have the polygonal shapes, and we can track cell divisions, like in this example, say extrusions and so on. Now, important quantities to measure are first the deformation of the tissue. And this can be measured and defined from scales, either on the scale of cells or on larger scales by averaging over groups of cells or the whole tissue. And the key quantity here is the deformation tensor, which is essentially a gradient of displacements. So it can be measured by comparing two subsequent frames and defining the displacements, the movements between these two frames. And the displacement gradients then define a tensorial object represented by a matrix, a 2x2 matrix, that characterizes deformations and can be decomposed uniquely into contributions, pure shear and no area changes. This is a symmetric traceless part of the matrix. Pure area changes. This is the isotropic or trace of the matrix. And everything that is asymmetric in this matrix gives rise to rotations or corresponds to rotations. So this shear tensor can be characterized by a little bar defining the axis of shear along which the shape elongates while it narrows in the opposite direction. Now, if we have a dynamic process, we are often interested in the deformation rate tensor. That's essentially the time derivative of the deformation tensor. And this deformation rate tensor can also be decomposed into shear rate, the compression or growth rate, and the rotation rate. Now, a second quantity that is very important characterizes local geometry, anisotropy of the geometry of cells. And this is most conveniently done by going from the polygonal representation of cells to a triangular representation, which is essentially the conjugate lattice of the polygonal lattice. And that is because when we define shape anisotropies by a tensor, a traceless symmetric tensor, then this tensor defines uniquely the shape of a triangle. And therefore, there's a unique relationship between triangles and tensors. Boris didn't like our terminology of calling it elongation, so I try to stick to calling it shape tensor here. But sometimes I always use the terminology of elongation, so don't be confused. And this elongation can be characterized by a little bar defining the axis of anisotropy of the shape. And using these triangles, this shape tensor can be defined in such a way, that's sort of the purpose, the most convenient definition, that for small changes between frames, so I should mention, stress that Q is a quantity that can be measured in a single frame. It's a property of the shape. And if I have two subsequent shapes with a small change in triangle shape, then Q is defined such that changes in Q are the same as the deformation tensor. And there's a small point to pay attention to here, is that it's strictly speaking, one has to take the change in Q in the coordinate system that rotates with the triangle as one moves from frame to frame. to calculate the deformation tensor. That is because with a pure rotation, if there's only a rotation between the two states, there's a change in Q, because Q has an axis which rotates, while a pure rotation is not associated with a deformation. And therefore, this is a co-rotational change that corresponds to the deformation.
But frankly, is there new information in this beyond the deformation tensor? As you show here, they're closely related. I would have thought that in an ordinary continuum elastic theory, you could track both the curl of the displacement field and the rotation of the triangle, etc.
Also, this is only the traceless part. Yeah? The deformation tensor itself has more information.
It has more information, but it has at least this amount.
It's at least it, yes. And this is a statement true for a single triangle. It becomes more complex when you look at a tissue, when things rearrange. It just comes later. For a single triangle, the definition is such that this holds, not for the tissue. And here I just show you an example of this cell shape anisotropy as a function of time, averaged over local regions. And I can see here that as this tissue undergoes remodeling and deformation, cells change their shape and become anisotropic, and there's a large-scale order of cell shape anisotropy in this tissue, which has a maximum. It starts out very irregular with a little anisotropy, and then there's a strong anisotropy, and then there's a relaxation. It becomes weaker later at the end. So we have an average elongation of cell shape along this proximal distal axis. And this is quantification is now shown here for the whole wing blade. But the projection of this matrix on the x-axis, and we have an increase in this cell shape anisotropy with a maximum and a relaxation. And at the same time, I can also measure the deformation of the whole wing blade and plot the deformation tensor, which is the cumulative shear rate. So the slope of this blue curve is the shear rate, and the value of the blue curve is the deformation. And the reason this tissue undergoes shear, it's on the schematic shown here. The tissue is attached at the boundaries to a rigid cuticle. The hinge region contracts, and therefore the tissue puts itself under external forcing, and it undergoes a shear. So it's stretched along this long axis, and it's narrowed on this axis. It's a shear deformation that is seen here. Now, interestingly, for single triangles, I said that U and Q should be related. But in this tissue, they're different. And this has to do with the fact that you have average over the whole tissue. So it's true for single triangles, it's not true for the average over the whole tissue. And this has to do with cell rearrangements that take place, neighborship changes. So the simple picture of having a packing of cells that starts to be stretched is that cells maintain their neighborships but change their shape. In that case, the tissue shear rate is just given by the time derivative of the cell shape tensor, and this is now a co-rotational time derivative for the reasons I mentioned earlier. Now, if cells change their neighborship, this has a correction, and that is because the tissue can also change its shape without cells changing their shape if the cells rearrange. So you see here the cells are all isotropic, but the overall packing has undergone shear, and the cells that were close to each other, 2 and 4, have moved apart, and those cells move close. And this can happen if there's a T1 process, where one shrinks, and now these two cells that were neighbors are no longer neighbors after this new bond is formed. This implies that rearrangements, even if cells don't change their shape, can contribute to tissue shear, and this then corresponds in this geometric relation to tissue shear, cell shape changes, to an extra contribution, which we call shear by cell rearrangement. So now I can add this information in this plot. The blue curve is the overall tissue shear. The green curve is the change of cell shape. And the red curve is the shear due to cell rearrangement, so that the green plus the red gives the blue. That's this equation. And it's interesting here to note that the cells deform more strongly than the tissue as a whole. And that's something that will be come up later again, and it is related to the fact that the red curve has a negative slope, even though the other two curves have a positive slope at early times.
Would T2 processes give another correction?
So T2 processes have a very weak contribution. So we can measure the contributions of individual processes, and they just summarize everything that remeshes the measure in the red curve without distinguishing. But we can distinguish between these curves, and T2 contributes more when you look at area rather than deformations.
But is it practical matter, are cells popping into the third dimension frequently or rarely?
I don't have the number in my head, but we can count them, and they occur at a reasonable rate.
And those cells just die? Or they
probably just die, yes.
They don't re-enter cells where...
I think they die, yes.
Frank, this is a bilayer. There's some dynamics on the other side, and I guess my question, I've never asked you this, how much agreement is there in all these descriptors, in cell divisions and rearrangements across the bilayer, or is this happening on one side and then the other side is slaved? What do you think the dynamics are across the bilayer?
It's difficult to observe the other side.
Of course.
And therefore I don't have this information, so we have been asking this question quite often. The two sides also, they start distant and they move together.
At this stage or
this stage, yes. I'm not talking about the third dimension here, but that's what's happening. And we don't know about this other side, but of course in the end we see that the two fit well together and probably the same process takes place there. And how they are coordinated is a big open question.
Can you tell? Is this because of like, can you use this to for factor like Q, the cell elongation and the shear by cell rearrangements to tell whether these are active to one?
I'll come to that. That will be discussion later.
And the two sides share a rigid boundary, right? And they're pooled.
So there's a rigid hull, yeah? And the margins, they share the same boundary, yes. Mm-hmm.
But, so how about the hinge, right? So if does the hinge get glued first so that the, so both sides are basically pulled more or less coherently by the same contraction in the hinge? Because the rest will then take care of itself. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they are closer, but certainly I think both sides have to do the same thing in order to get the outcome. And we cannot observe it with this depth of information with our methods. So at early times, what I just said is that the cells extend more than the tissue. This is schematically shown here. And this has to do with the fact that T1 transitions are on average oriented such that horizontal bonds would rather contract and vertical bonds would expand. The orientations are sort of shown here. And in that case, we pull on these cells because they get close to each other even more than the whole tissue expands. That's the orientation of the T1 transitions, which corresponds to this negative slope. And then as we go to later times, the slope of the red curve is changed. So now what happens is that the orientation of the T1 transitions, on average, of course, it's an average statement, changes. And now it's these bonds which no longer contract, but now expand. And that gives rise to this sign. And as a consequence now, the sign of the change in cell shape changes. So now the cell elongation is reduced, and this corresponds to this red curve relaxing down. So the T1 transitions here relax the elongation, and these T1 transitions seem to increase the elongation beyond the tissue shape. And now let's discuss the physics of these processes in a convenient vertex model. So we can describe the mechanics of the polygonal meshwork. In using such a what we call it work function, it's sort of a potential for the elastic properties of this network, and we can discuss now in such a model the mechanical properties of this material. And first, if we start from a situation where cells are isotropic, and we then force the network to stretch, then there will be a stress on average. And this can be captured, a shear stress. And this can be captured by such an equation. There's a shear stress that is proportional to the shape anisotropy. This has to do with the fact that all these now bonds under tension have now an anisotropic angular distribution and as a net anisotropic stress. And K is a shear elastic modulus of this network. And if we take such a state, and we have to think in terms of that there are fluctuations, the center system is fluctuating, and there will be stochastic T1 transitions triggered by these fluctuations. And if the, of course, if the cell shapes are isotropic, this T1 transition will be isotropic as well, but if the cell shapes are anisotropic, there's a higher probability for short bonds to disappear and for horizontal long bonds to be formed. And as a result, we have a rate of shear due to cell rearrangements, which is related to the cell shape anisotropy. So in linear order, it's proportional to Q, and the coefficient here must be an inverse time, because this is a rate and this is dimensionless. So a time scale here. And this gives us a sort of a model for this material. And here I show you a simulation of such a system with fluctuations, where we impose the shear of the outside shape, and then we do the decomposition in different contributions during this process. And you see, if you take the system and you shear it, instantaneously the cell shapes follow the shear. So the blue curve is the shear, and the slope is the shear rate. So first the cells follow in their shape change the external deformation, but then they relax to some constant shape anisotropy, and the shear is then generated with the T1 transitions into the anisotropy. And as the shear process stops and we have a constant shape, now we have a relaxation of the shape by the tropic again and a relaxation of the T1 transitions. And this, I just highlight here in this example, I start this movie now after it has been deformed. So initially you saw the cells are more stretched, it's elongated, and now the elongation relaxes to zero. And this happens here, these T1 transitions, or shear due to T1 transitions, it's not at this red curve. And using these equations, one finds an exponential decay of the elongation with this relaxation time tau. So in this example, V is zero because we keep the shape fixed, let the inside relax. So dQ dt is minus R, and then we get this relaxation process. But that's an isotropic. Yeah.
So if you run this shear in a simulation slow enough, you still get this kind of stretching and then relaxation, or will it just?
Of course, it depends on relative shear rate relative to this relaxation time.
Okay.
Yes.
So I'm assuming that you have the ones that are happening because there's active process happening, the ones that are just a result, passive result, and the environment is pulling them. So, and very much for other processes, they can be passive and active. Right? So, do you have any ability in this approach to see what's what?
That's what I'm trying to come and get at. Yeah? So this, in some sense, is passive, what I'm describing here. But it's driven by the outside shape change. But of course, the processes that vary fluctuations, for example, are of course active processes.
Do you understand where the relaxation time comes from? Is it depending on system size, for example?
At this moment, it is a phenomenological coefficient. In the vertex model, I can understand where it comes from. For example, to do this simulation, I'm introducing fluctuations of the tensions on the bonds. And these fluctuations have a relaxation time. This relaxation time is then related to this time scale.
So it's a local quantity.
It's a local quantity, yes.
Doesn't change dramatically if you were to change the size.
In this model, it's a local quantity, yes.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm perfectly happy to introduce this dependence of T1 dot shape just as a phenomenological parameter. But you seem to have some argument for it being that particular. Can you just go back one slide?
So somehow this argument is to motivate it, and then I show you in a model that it actually works. So it can also be the other way around. I could first show you the model, and then it's a symmetry argument. Yeah? The symmetry is broken, so the probability for different types of bonds will be different. And that gives a bias.
But in that picture, both right and left are, so as far as the shape, they're exactly the same, right? And I can certainly change the shape of cells in the regular hexagonal piling just by squeezing it right? Your left thing, I can just squeeze along the horizontal axis. The shape will change, but
the T1 will change the shape, and you will relax with the T1 transition. You will relax the cube, and you relax the stress. And of course, everything depends on boundary conditions, which are not really clearly shown in this drawing. But that's why I need a simulation to make it really clear. And now the next step related to the questions we had here is now to ask what happens if things are a bit more complicated, if cells are not isotropic, and what if they are isotropic in shape but anisotropic in their mechanical properties? This would be something.
Frank, can I ask you?
Yeah.
So this shape tensor captures both anisotropy of the shape but also that aligned, right?
Because of?
It captures both anisotropy of cell shape but also alignment.
If I average over a region, right. It averages the order of the
Right.
That sense, it also captures the.
Had anisotropic shapes, but they were.
the way I average it.
Yeah.
It gives me also the order parameter.
Yeah.
But of course, I could also average the magnitudes. There are different ways I can, and then I only have the shape anisotropy with.
Right, but if you had anisotropic shapes and they were oriented randomly, this Q would be zero.
The average Q will be zero, exactly. Now let's look at a case where I have bonds which have high tension and bonds which have low tension. And I assume there is some guiding Q, a cell anisotropy, which is along this axis, which defines that bonds along this axis have a higher tension than other bonds. Now first, this changes the mechanical properties. Because if I now allow the system to relax with external stress zero, then these bonds will tend to shrink, and this will increase their length. So in a no-stress state, these cells will have an anisotropic shape. And this can be captured now by adding this term to my material equation. The stress has a shear elastic stress plus a stress due to the anisotropy of the bond tension. And this anisotropic stress is along this axis. So there is a coefficient zeta, which is positive. This now shows that we call it an active stress, because it's the same term that we find in our hydrodynamic theories of active matter. And it also, in the tissue, is generated by actomyosin systems. So a good reason to think of it as an active term.
So K and zeta are actually fourth-rank tensors?
I treat them as
simplifying things a lot. Yeah.
If Q is there, this becomes a fourth-rank tensor in general. Mm-hmm. I simplify it here.
And you know all the coefficients for a filing?
That would be nice to measure. For the moment, I don't know the coefficients, if I take those numbers. Okay, so this is now the mechanical equation. Now we can ask what happens with T1 transitions. Now here, the idea is that the probability that the high-tension bonds disappear in the T1 transition is higher than the low bond tensions, rather than that the low potentials can be expanded more easily. So there's also an asymmetry here. An asymmetry argument suggests that now the rate of shear due to T1s is proportional to this anisotropy Q, which comes from the cell bonds. And taking this literally, we see that now the orientation of the T1s is perpendicular to the orientation of the active stress. So this means that this coefficient lambda between R and Q is negative. Of course, in general, I do not know what the sign of this phenomenological coefficient is. But in this picture, I suggest it's negative, and this can be tested again in the vertex model. If I make now the bond tension, just here, constant plus a function of angle, it's angle relative to Q, then I have a version that takes these orientation dependent bond tensions into account. And if I start with a more or less isotropic shape picture and I run this at fixed boundary conditions, I generate T1 transitions. So the anisotropy of the tension works. And it does it in exactly the sign that I suggest here, that the higher bond tensions tend to shrink and those tend to increase. Because the R is horizontal, and as a consequence, we find that the change in cell shape is along this line. So the cells start to be elongated along the axis Q of little q, because of the T1 transition that oriented to the horizontal axis.
Does your model give you rosettes? Do you get rosettes?
In this simple model, you typically don't get rosettes. But of course, with more coordinated activity of bonds, you might get them. But we didn't try to do that. But the symmetry arguments are independent of this type of structures. But it's simpler.
Yes. The passive response is a three-dimensional response of a cohort of cells. It's sort of, I guess I'm asking you a question. Whether the three, I mean, if there are just some boundary conditions or pulling forces at the boundary, the thing must respond as a three-dimensional material. But of course, the actomyosin, at least what we believe, is apically localized. So maybe just I'm asking for a comment. What do you think the consequence of the fact that there's this difference, and really whether a cell decides to change shape versus topology, is some very complicated function of this 3D versus 2D thing, right?
I can project it on 2D, and I'm just using symmetry arguments. And the symmetry arguments hold, but of course the details matter to understand exactly what happens. But I don't want to go into this details of the third dimension. I want to highlight some very basic principles, which I think are independent of the dimensionality. So this implies that these T1 transitions drive cell shape changes that build up shear stress. And as I will argue, I think of them as active. And this is then shown if you do the decomposition of this process here. These are the T1 shear due to T1 transitions, which is horizontal orientation. And since the overall box is fixed, it can only result in cell shape changes, and they must have the opposite sign. And the cell elongating the opposite sign with a tensor means 90 degrees orientation relative to this one. And this red curve is positive if lambda in my coefficient lambda is negative. If I would change the sign of the coefficient, I would exchange the sign of the red and the green curve. Now let's discuss active versus passive. We had this question before. And this one can do by looking sort of at the sign of the work that takes place in the system. So I can do work and energy balance in this tissue. And if I think of a tissue as a material, let's take for a moment no cell rearrangements, that is an elastic material. If I deform it, then the elastic work done on the material is the product of the stress and the deformation rate. And if this product is positive, I'm performing work on the tissue. If this product is negative, the tissue performs work on the outside. The other extreme case is that I don't allow the tissue to deform, but I allow cells to rearrange. Having cell rearrangements, I can also work elastically on the network. And the elastic work due to cell rearrangements in the absence of the deformation of the tissue is stress multiplied by R with a minus sign. So this is the work done on the tissue by rearrangement or by T1 transitions. If this is positive, if this is negative, then this is the work the tissue performs on the rearrangements. Now the idea is to say whenever this here is negative, the work done by T1 on the tissue, negative means now that this flow goes the other way, then it's passive. It means that the elastic energy is used to drive rearrangements. While if this sign is positive, then it's actually the T1 transitions performing elastic work on the network. And one can use this idea to build sort of an energy balance for the system, but it has also to take into account other contributions. That's my definition of active and passive T1 transitions, and we can just look at our two cases. If I take the... Yes?
So you have this active contribution for cellular arrangements, but did you include any possibility for active shape change here?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that.
Sorry, does that...
I don't have it here. My active stress term in the stress is something like an active shape change, if you keep the stress fixed, then it will change the shape actively. So in that sense, it's there. So if I take this case of isotropic cell properties, I deform the cells and I get T1 transitions. This is my rate of T1 transition. This is the stress. I can calculate the product, and it's negative, showing that it's passive. If I go to the case where I have anisotropic cell bond tension, my rate of cell rearrangements and shear due to cell rearrangements is lambda times Q, as shown before. The stress, if I start with isotropic cells, is the active stress. If I calculate the product of the two, it now depends on the signs of lambda and sigma, and I showed before that they have opposite signs. And because they have opposite signs, as negative, we find that this force is active. So the work goes from the elastic network to the cell bonds work on the tissue, and it goes to T1 transitions. So I call this active, which build up stress in the tissue, which build up elastic energy in the tissue. Now, in order to understand whether active or passive transitions occur in the experiments, we need to know what the stress is, because it's the stress times this deformation quantities V or R that we need to understand. Now, we cannot directly measure the stress, but there is sort of, we can infer information about the stress by doing ablation experiments. So if you take a tissue and take a circular cut of the tissue, then the tissue relaxes and typically opens, cut boundary opens up and becomes ellipsoidal. And the inside shrinks and also becomes ellipsoidal. That's hard to see here. And I can use now the size change as a hint about isotropic stresses and the shape change as information about anisotropic stresses. So here I show you the anisotropic part of this change, which has an axis, given the average cell anisotropy, shape anisotropy in the tissue where the cut occurs. That's the question.
So I'm a little puzzled about using the shape of the hole as the readout for stress, since your cut is itself anisotropic, or could be anisotropic.
What do you mean by isotropic? It's, we try to be as circular as possible.
So,
the cut is a circle. We're cutting a circle. And we try to be as circular as possible, and the circle as homogeneous as possible along the circle. And then we start out with a circular cut.
And it's a small circle.
Oh, you can vary it.
But so on the scale of a cell?
It usually it's more than a cell. We take a few cells. If it's too big, it's not so easy to do. If it's too small, it doesn't work. We vary the size of the circle.
I guess maybe Boris is worried that if it's just two or three cells, there's some memory of the actual irregularities of those particular three cells that will...
That is part of the noise.
It's a little hard to interpret.
That is subject to the noise that we see here today. Because we have to do many of those in average. And also, we can do it with larger cuts. And you see here, it's bigger than...
And this is linear elasticity theory, it's some gradient expansion. So you're neglecting higher order terms. Do you have a sense of the size of the terms you're neglecting?
No, we don't. It's just that this works, it describes very well the deformation. So we don't see corrections needed to describe the deformations. Anyway, do that. But it would be very interesting to see the nonlinearities, which certainly are there. In that sense, we are at a very crude level, because the material properties are so unknown that first we have to look at linear properties before we go to nonlinear ones.
As you know, thin sheets that have negative or small stress can be highly nonlinear.
Yes. So, taking this as a... So the idea is, in the region where we do the cut, we measure the cell shape anisotropy average over the region. That's the horizontal axis. We plot the anisotropic velocity, and this is consistent with this picture. Let's put it that way. And it gives some information about these coefficients. And I don't want to go into these details here because there are some interesting aspects of how to do this in some detail. But my point here is we have an idea that there's a shear elastic modulus and there's a positive coefficient zeta. which is all we need to determine the sign of the work that I just talked. In that sense, we can now argue that these transitions at early times correspond to a situation that early times the cells are almost isotropic, so this term is weak as compared to this term. We have actively driven G1 transitions using this definition, and we build up cell shape chains by these G1 transitions, which also build up elastic stress in this tissue. And then at later times, as we have a build up a lot of cell shape anisotropy, this term can become more important and drive this realization process, which, according to this definition, is dominated by passive T1s that are driven by the build-up stress. And putting all of this together, we come up sort of to a continuum theory of such a material. It's very much oversimplified, so of course all these comments are highly relevant, but I just want to sort of come up with the simplest version, where we have a constitutive equation for the material property, which is essentially elastic with some anisotropic stress that can occur. It describes essentially the cell elasticity. Then, as cells rearrange, we have a relationship between the material deformations, the cell shape changes, and shear due to rearrangements. And the shear due to rearrangements, the linear order, has these two contributions, one stemming from anisotropics of the cell shape and one stemming from anisotropics of the cell tension. And that this has to be complemented with equations for the isotropic material properties, which I don't want to go into today. It's much more complicated what I write here. The simplest version is just a two-dimensional pressure. And then we have force balances. And this then gives rise to equations for the tissue dynamics, including cell shapes.
So if I were to double the ATP resources available for the wing in some artificial way, or have a mutant that's just overproduced ATP and used it mechanically, which of these coefficients would change? Would that be a way of testing the theory, maybe?
I'm not sure if changing ATP is a perturbation that makes it easy, but clearly this is what is an active stress to the aberrations. We need some cell anisotropies, which are still unclear what they exactly are, some PCP systems. This is a geometric relationship, which is subject to change. And the sort of most crucial is this one. This is a very simplified version. We also have complicated versions of this constitutive relation.
So the fact that it's a living material, an active material, is embodied in these two terms.
Yes.
Another perturbation could be preventing T1s by increasing adhesion or decreasing their turnover. What would it
change? That would definitely change these coefficients here. Yes.
So this quantification, is it just for the intervein regions, or have you looked at the heterogeneity within the differentiating vein regions?
So the data I showed you was everything just averaged. We also have done separately intervein regions and veins, but the veins don't change some. They are very different, but they don't have a strong influence on the result. That's why I show you here just the brutal average over everything. But the veins are by themselves a very interesting subject, and that's ongoing work. Now let's just apply this technique briefly on an example of the wing disc to show you what one can learn. This is again the wing vaginal disc with a segmentation of the process where you can now look at these quantifications. And
so what are the blue cells?
I think these are the cell divisions are marked here.
Okay.
Now, this is a growing tissue, so I just want to briefly also mention that we can also measure, of course, the area growth rate, A dot over A, which I call G. And we can decompose this area growth rate in, again, a geometric decomposition as for the shear, the area can change because cell area has changed, or because we have divisions and extrusions. And you see here sort of some of these three curves together gives the blue curve. And in this culture, there's an initial time of about 2 hours where the system somehow has to adjust, and then it's actually to grow.
Do you include an isotropic stress associated to the division? Do you include any anisotropic stress associated to divisions? When a cell divides, actually, you induce a local anisotropic stress also, beyond the changing area. So the doubling of the cell is a changing area, but when it divides...
You mean in which model? Because in the continuum model.
In the continuum, yeah.
I didn't write it down, but...
You think it's important?
I don't know. Now, this is the decomposition of the shear. So this growing tissue undergoes shear. It's an anisotropic growth. And Ken Irvine already showed this, essentially the same process. So the overall shear of the tissue is the blue curve. And here, the simplest interpretation is that cell shape changes and also T1 transitions follow passively this process. Essentially, the picture is that you have a growth which is not allowed, which is sort of confined in, let's say, in the x direction. It can only grow in the y direction. And that would give you exactly such a decomposition. It's unclear what leads to this anisotropy, and I don't want to go into this today. What I want to show briefly is a second analysis we can do with the same tissue. Rather than averaging all the tensors in the plane as before, we can also look at radial patterns.
So are the cell division driving the T1 transitions?
I don't say anything about who drives whom. I'm just stating geometric effects. I'm saying it's consistent with everybody following the overall deformation. And I don't have a theory for that here. What I want to discuss here is a radial decomposition. So the idea is to do the same analysis but projecting everything on the radial axis relative to center. One can define as that there are radially symmetric patterns here that one can see in the data. And one can define a center. And now we extract from this very noisy data those features that on average are radial. So we define, so the average after projecting on the R direction around the whole circle. And we can decompose now the radial component of this tensor in the same way as before. And we find a pattern that there are T1 transitions and cell shape anisotropies, which have a radial pattern. So the T1 transitions tend to extend along the radial axis, and the cell shape changes are tangential. And this is shown in this data here. So this is now the radial decomposition as a function of time. Again, the cumulative shear is because we average over the radius and there's not much growth, the overall shear is zero. That's just by symmetry, that's what comes out. But we have a positive contribution of T1s and a negative contribution of cell-shaped changes. This corresponds to this picture. And then here we can now use our theory that I highlighted to solve the mechanical problem in such a circle. And this can, I should just highlight again that now we have the radial axis and we have the ones that tend to extend along the radial axis. And cells stretch tangentially.
And this is all well before you start forming the ribs of the wing?
It's probably, they're already faults.
There are already some vestigial faults. Ribs, which presumably is going to mess up your radial anisotropy.
There are structures which mess up the radial anisotropy, which come from the Poincaré boundaries, the EV and AP boundary. And we're also analyzing that. I just don't want to go into this today. But there's an underlying radial pattern, which you can also, as it's not very easy to see here, but if you look at the cell shapes, you see particular in the outer region that there are elongated cells around. And what this analysis generates, so if you take active T1s that are radial, you will generate not only a pattern of cell shape anisotropy, which you have show you the measured pattern in the ring and the calculated from this mechanical model. You also generate an area pressure inside because you have a sort of a ring of tension because of the elongated cells, which compresses the center. And that's why you get a pattern of cell area, which is consistent with what you see in the experiment, and you get smaller areas in the center. So the hypothesis here is that radial T1s drive cell shape changes and at the same time generate a cell area pattern.
Yes. Frank, maybe you misunderstand, but there's also another ingredient, which is that there's a boundary around this pouch, so to speak. And if I remember my developmental genetics, there's a wingless, there's a sort of ring of wingless, yes, that sort of delineates the pouch.
Yes.
But your explanation almost requires a mechanical boundary around the pouch to give the symmetries that you observe. And I guess my question is there a fold? Is there, what is at the wing pouch that provides?
So here you see a fold.
So you think it's the, so it's the folds. And what sets those?
I don't know if it's a mechanical or a chemical bounding condition. For the moment, I also cannot tell you what generates this radial pattern. Here, I'm measuring a radial pattern, and I'm using a simple theoretical analysis based on radial symmetry.
But there is a physical fold there, as well as a gene expression boundary, and we also know that it's a clonal boundary. So clones tend not to cross from wing to notum. It's not impossible for them to do it, but they tend not to do it. So just as veins and obviously AP are clonal boundaries, the wing pouch notum border is also one such. So we don't know what the properties are. What is it that the cells know not to cross there or in many other boundaries? But there is some kind of biological property that could fulfill what you're talking about.
But we don't know if it's a chemical or a mechanical boundary. It could be both. Could be one or the other. Yes, Boris?
So how about growth and uniformity of growth or non-uniformity of growth?
I'll come to that. But growth seems to be rather uniform. But of course, it's an approximation.
So are there more T1 transition in the center of the disk or at the periphery of the disk?
I don't know the distribution.
Wouldn't that be important information if it is not homogeneous?
We need the number of T1s is not necessarily the most important information, because what happens is, what is the average orientation? You have to average the T1s as we have to do the tensorial average of the T1s to get their effect. And that's the R profile.
But the location of the T1s is recent, isn't it important?
We can measure that, but it's noisy data. I forgot what it looks like. In the simple picture, we take it to be the same everywhere. And that gives you a consistent outcome as with the external data. That's enough to make it constant. Don't need a pattern. Okay, so I'm doing time. So that's what I wanted to tell you about active tissue material properties and tissue modeling. So now I want to switch gears and talk about growth. And this is sort of take a completely different perspective also. So the question now is, how can such a tissue organize its own growth? And I want to highlight some basic ideas about that. And that's a collaboration that we've been going on for a long time with Marcus González Gaitán, who is also going to give the next talk. And many of the things that I'm alluding to, he will discuss in much more depth. And I'd like to highlight in particular, of course, Ortrud Wartlik, Zena and Maria. And on the theory side, Daniel and Steffen. Mentioned Pair, because I'm showing a movie of this. So I'm coming back to the wing disk, but now I'm asking about how does this growth happen. And some years ago, we've quantified the growth of the whole wing disk. And here you see the area of the wing disk as a function of time. And this reveals sort of the type of growth process that forms this tissue. So this is a single logarithmic plot. So the slope of these fit functions is the growth rate, the area growth rate. I call this area growth rate G, A dot over A. And the functions that are fit here to the data are functions where the growth rate decays exponentially in time. And if one integrates this up, then the area as a function of time has this functional form, and that's what's plotted here. So you see that there's a characteristic time scale over which the growth rate decays, starting from a maximal value. And as it decays, the slope of this curve goes down. And if you take this function, you see that at long times, it goes to a finite size. Because this exponential dies out, and we just have a naught e to the g naught t as a finite size. And the time in which this happens can be measured here as about 30 hours. Now this growth is anisotropy, as I mentioned. And when we characterize the anisotropy by the fact that the area and the linear size don't scale like a square. There's an I call this anisotropy epsilon. Epsilon equals 1 would be an isotropic growth. And Boris asked this question, the growth is to a good approximation homogeneous. It's not truly homogeneous. But I highlight here labeled dividing cells at different times. They're sprinkled around the area. And of course, one can discuss about what it means. But there's no sharp gradient.
Of course, over a period of time, if there is a systematic bias, it can accumulate, right?
Yeah, there is a I think there's a profile, but it's not easy to measure. Right. And I'm not saying there is
the
a profile.
Tissue morphology, so the fact that the high density of cells and, you know, there's a sort of thicker stratified epithelium.
But we
actually sort of suggests that
actually we took
over the days it accumulates.
But we took the cell area change in account, and it's not very big. It's a factor of 2, you know, cell area changes, while the tissue size goes by a huge factor. So it doesn't have such a strong influence. It's the fact that cells are smaller in a set. You should make this analysis.
Can you look locally though to see if there's a cell division, whether the cells in the immediate vicinity delay their divisions as a result, or they're under some compression locally, which takes a while to relax?
That's something we can probably extract from these movies, but I don't have the information. And here, in this part of my talk, I take a more coarse-grained picture. I will not zoom into a small scale. And this is certainly important to do, but it's also tricky because it's very noisy. So the question I want to ask is, how can we organize such a collection of cells to self-organize into a growth process that goes to a finite size, that slows down its growth, that is more or less homogeneous, and that is stable and well controlled? And Ken Urban already introduced these Morphogen gradients in the wing disk, which are, in particular here, I want to focus on the DPP, a gradient which is formed near the compartment boundary between the posterior and anterior compartment with the help of hedgehog signaling, and hedgehog is another morphogen. So there's a local source, and then there's a spread of this molecule in the tissue. Again, something that Marcus will talk much more about in the next talk. It forms a graded concentration profile, which can be quantified. It can often be well fit by exponential functions, so I can define a length scale over which it ranges. And this DPP profile is a growth stimulant. So you can think of it as a growth factor. And I want to discuss scenarios of growth regulation. Now, from the theoretical point of view, we have taken a coarse grain point of view, and then the description of such a morphogen that evolves in time in a tissue, in a growing tissue, would be captured by such a diffusion degradation convection equation. So time dependence, this is the, if the cells have a velocity, we have this convection term, and diffusion, we have degradation, which takes out molecules from the pool, and we have local source, which depends on where we are, whether it exists or not. And the velocity field is related to growth. So if the tissue would not grow, we would not have this velocity field. But as the tissue grows, the divergence of the cell velocity is the growth rate, and in addition we'll take into account anisotropies of growth, which then reflect themselves in the structure of the velocity field. Now, different scenarios have been discussed. The idea that EBP somehow has a spatial control via its spatial gradient. The idea that mechanical stresses play a key role in this growth control. And I want to highlight the hypothesis that it's a temporal control of DPP, which of course not doesn't exclude a combination of these phenomena, but that the growth stimulant of DPP has to do with dynamic changes of DPP signaling. And I want to show you that this hypothesis of dynamic changes of DPP signaling provide a very elegant and simple theory of self-organized growth.
How well are DPP and Winkler's gradients reflected in SMART1 in beta-catenin levels? Because that will reflect the active DPP or active Winkler's signaling.
So I will mainly discuss DPP as a signal the cells receive. I will not really discuss the details of the signaling transduction by the cell. I will take this as a black box where you get a stimulus as an input and then maybe growth as an output, and I'll come a little bit to that. But I will not go into this detail. It's something that may come up more in the next talk, but we can discuss that. Now, an important property of the DPP gradient that is key to understanding growth and also understanding patterning is scaling of these gradients. So if one quantifies the profile as a function of time, they exhibit scaling properties. And essentially, in a nutshell, it's shown here, the shape of the profile doesn't change with time, but it's being stretched as the tissue grows. So that is a linear dimension of the tissue. And the amplitude changes with time. So the amplitude of this profile increases in scales with tissue area. And I can extract an exponent by plotting a double logarithmic plot. And if I superimpose profiles at different times, and I rescale them from 0 to 1, so that they always fit in the same interval, and I scale it to 1 at the maximum, then they essentially collapse on the same curve. That's this function psi. R is sort of the scaled position variable. And this implies that as the tissue grows, profile decreases in amplitude and stretch out. That's called scaling. That's something that was also extensively discussed by Nama Barkai and Ben Shilo. And it, of course, it's probably related to the fact that we are dealing here with scalable pattern generators. Yeah, these are systems which can generate morphology at different sizes using the same principles and molecules. And having a system that provides scalable patterns to growth is a proper system for that. Now, an important question is to understand where does this scaling come from. And again, Nama Barkai has done seminal work on that. There are ideas that the degradation rate of DPP is regulated as the tissue grows in a way to keep the decay length proportional to tissue size. And proteins such as Pentagon and Deli have been invoked in this process. So that we need a K that goes to like 1 over L squared in some feedback system to achieve that this decay length scales. Now, Barkai had also pointed out that the growth process itself can give rise to scaling. And in my talk, I will use both ideas, and you'll see a combination of both ideas that account for the observed behavior of the ring-dimensional disk. So Marcus will talk much more about the system in his talk. I will just keep them as in a very superficial and simplified way. Now, an important consequence of scaling allows to relate the morphogen profile of DPP to growth. We have the scaling of the amplitude with the area, which implies that the overall amplitude, look at its rate of change divided by the value itself, is proportional to the growth rate. And the proportional coefficient is the slope in the log-log plot here, this exponent beta. Now, if the gradient scales, and if growth is homogeneous, then there is a very interesting consequence. And that is, for every cell inside this profile, the level of DPP it receives per time, or the relative rate of change of DPP it receives per time, is the same everywhere. It's a global property. That requires scaling to be correct. And that means there's a correlation between the growth rate in the tissue, A dot over A, and the relative rate of change of DPP that cells perceive everywhere in the tissue. And the coefficient of proportionality is related to this beta. And now we've taken this correlation, which can be seen in the data, as a hint as to a causal effect, namely that this could be a rule by which DPP stimulates growth. So now we can turn this into a rule that the process which detects DPP and processes it in the cell, the signaling pathway that then stimulates growth, follows such a rule. And beta now becomes a parameter of the signaling transduction pathway that characterizes growth control. And the idea is now that changes in the amplitude of the gradient drive, stimulate growth, and in a way that it's the relative rate of change.
Is that only in the case when the growth is only in one direction?
Growth, of course, this is a two-dimensional growth.
Okay.
But the gradient goes only one axis.
Okay, so it's a kind of, I don't really see here how it interfaces.
I just first try to lay out the principles, and I want to do some theory.
Just to return to this hypothesis, yeah. The K degradation rate goes like 1 over L squared. Mm-hmm. Is that reasonable? I mean, how could these proteins that are degrading at a local level know something about the link size?
Yeah, there are ideas about it, and you can find it in these papers. The simplest version even actually is just having a dilution effect. If you have molecules that don't degrade and are diluted as the tissue grows, they provide information about 1 over area. Now, Abarca has come up with an expansion repression feedback system, which can also achieve that. And
D is the diffusion constant of the morphogen, so yes. Maybe it's regulating its viscosity, so it's L-dependent. So the diffusion constant changes.
Yes, it could also. It seems from the data we have, the diffusion coefficient doesn't seem to change much when you have measurements.
You can measure it
to some degree using FRAP analysis. Okay. And Marcus goes into a lot of detail how to measure these coefficients. He's an effective diffusion coefficient, which is a quite complex property, and Marcus will talk about that.
Frank, it assumes that you're at the steady state, yeah, and that during growth.
I'll come to all of that, yes. I'm just starting simply here. So this is a correlation in the wing data, and we took it as a hint for a causality. To test this idea, whether it's more than a correlation, we actually looked at the eye, the fly eye, which has the same molecular players, but a completely different setting. In the fly eye, we have a furrow, which also produces source of DPP, and there's a gradient of DPP in the system. But this furrow moves. From the posterior to the anterior side. And because of this motion, cells in this region out here receive a wave of DPP. And this translates this temporal rule into a spatial rule. And we can quantify the signaling gradient of DPP signaling in this target tissue along with the tissue on this side where the furrow moves into, and the growth rate. And starting from the black fit plug-in in this equation, we get a red curve, which fits the observed growth profile. In the eye, we find a wave of cell proliferation and cell growth. it's spatially inhomogeneous. There's a localized region of maximal growth. And surprisingly, this is fully can be fully explained quantitatively by this idea. And this is, of course, a completely different context, and therefore we think of this as a very strong evidence that this is actually causality, not just a correlation.
Does beta have to be the same between these two very different systems? Your beta equals 0.6, you said?
Yeah, beta doesn't have to be the same. I forgot exactly what the value here is. It's probably slightly different.
Oh, I see. So but, if you fit the beta, you get a different beta.
Yeah, but not very much different. Because as I'll point out at the moment, beta is important. You need to be in a certain range of parameters for this to work, and I'll come to them in a way. I forgot what the value in the I was. It's in the indeterminist paper. The question. So this shows that the same idea in the wing and the I can account for cell division in completely different settings. Now it may look surprising to have such a rule of relative rate of change, but in fact it's a quite natural property of adaptive sensors. So if you think of the DPP signaling system, which transduces binding of DPP to some receptors into some output, which in our case would be growth, there's a complex biochemical signaling pathway in between. And what the signaling pathway has to do in order to account for our hypothesis is to be an adaptive sensor. This has been measuring relative changes is something which Uri Allon terms fold change detection. It's a very general principle of signaling pathways. And you also find it in chemotactic signaling systems. And you have to cope with huge changes of signaling levels. Particularly chemotactic, of course, you have kind of high concentrations, very low concentrations. And this works typically with signaling processes that become sensitive when the ambient concentration is very small and become insensitive when the concentration is high and you need to have much bigger changes in order to have an effect. So you measure relative changes. And of course also this rule cannot be strictly true when C goes to zero. So there must be a maximal growth rate. So it's only true for in this linear regime and then it must saturate at some point. But in my arguments in the CUM, I will assume we are operating this regime down here. And we are away from this maximal rate. And of course, this maximal rate will also depend on stresses where then the mechanical feedbacks are at. So in the last minute, I want to discuss the physics of this idea and highlight that this provides a very elegant, very simple model of self-organized growth. Yes?
Sorry, Frank, I remember there was a paper by Eric Sigier where he sort of explored these adaptive things in the TGF-beta pathway. And there, the simplistic understanding, if I remember correctly, was that the timescales of phosphorylation and dephosphorylation actually set the scale of adaptation. Sorry. And I guess my question is, could you look at those mutants and ask if indeed the growth rate changes when you alter those phosphorylation times.
Interesting question. Certainly there is a time scale of adaptation.
Indeed.
And only beyond this time scale are you in a regime where you really measure C dot over C.
Indeed.
If you're faster, you're not seeing something else.
It's sort of viscoelastic, yeah.
So you need a separation of time scales there, and it would be interesting to change this time scale, absolutely. So the idea is we have this equation drift, diffusion, degradation, source for the profile. This equation lives on a growing medium, a growing substrate, and the growth itself is regulated by relative rates of change.
The divergence of V is still G in this theory.
Divergence of V is G, exactly. And we need the velocity field also to calculate this material time derivative, because this is what the cell perceives. So it's the partial derivative plus V grad C. And I want to first highlight sort of the structure of this problem, what type of problem it is. And so these are these two equations, and maybe I do that on the blackboard for a moment. So I'm starting with these two equations, and I want to show you how they define the growth process. So first, it's useful to realize that the convection term has sort of two parts. So V grad C and C divergence V. And this here is exactly what I call C dot. And I also have this here is G, because the divergence of V is G. So I can write this as C dot equals E Laplace C minus K plus G C plus mu. And I can use my growth rule to eliminate C. And now I can find an equation for G itself. And I can do that directly now in a one-dimensional case where I have a function C of X. It's simpler. And then I have G as the form D gradient square C minus KC plus mu divided by 1 plus beta C. What this shows is that if I have a profile of C, this defines a profile of growth instantaneously. If I start with a profile of C, which is steady state in the absence of growth, then G will be zero, it's self-consistent. But the moment I have a profile which is not steady state, then this defines growth. And now this then defines a growth with change in C, which has the form so this is the dynamic equation for C, and this is then the corresponding growth. And let's add a little bit of space here to clarify. In the simplest version, which is one-dimensional, I can think of the growth profile as stemming from the divergence of V. And I will just define the growth anisotropy as dy vy over dx. Vx, and then I have G equals Tx Vx times 1 plus epsilon. And so I can calculate V, which I need for C dot, is now Vtc plus Vx C. And the Vx I now get is an integral so this defines now completely my nonlinear dynamic system.
I guess I'm missing something. I thought you were in one dimension, and now you're looking at...
I'm not in one dimension. I'm having a profile which only
profile
depends
on one dimension. Right. So you're allowing the
velocity. For the velocity, I allow a velocity in y direction, which I have. I cannot ignore the y velocity. But I can write it in a form where everything only depends on x. And therefore, I also have a g of x simplicity. And then it's a simplified version of a two-dimensional problem. Yes?
So presumably have some dimensionless parameter which tells you how important the direction velocity is, right? So what is it? Right? There's some characteristic scale of the gradient, right? So velocity divided by this characteristic scale gives you the rate that's to be compared to k, right? What is that ratio of?
So the growth rate is sort of 8 hours and longer, and k is of the order of an hour or 45 minutes. So there's a factor of 10 between the two.
Sorry, I didn't quite parse.
There's a factor of 10 between the two.
Which way?
This time scale, the growth is slow as compared to degradation. Okay. And I'll come to that in a moment. But so there is a factor of 10-20. And you may argue you can neglect it. It turns out you cannot really neglect it. So, So this is now the dynamics, and I think I have it here in one dimension. And while the equation for the concentration itself is a linear equation, this is an interesting nonlinear problem. Yes?
And again, I'm sorry to bring up Eric's paper again, but there, the response, so the simple adaptive model says the time scale of change in ligand presentation is what, that's the same time scale of the signal transduction in the cell. Whereas you seem to have huge disparity between...
I'm not sure what you mean. Can we discuss it later? Let me just finish this story. We can discuss it later. Now this interesting point I want to make here is that these equations, which if we solve them numerically, are not so easy to solve. They generate, in general, inhomogeneous growth, interesting growth profiles, but they have homogeneous growth solutions. And one can see that most easily when, so in an eliminated C dot here, right, if I take this equation and multiply with 1 plus beta C, I get this equation. And this looks like a steady state equation of a diffusion degradation process with an effective degradation rate. And if I have homogeneous growth, G is just a number at every time point. And then I get exponential solutions. And the length scale in this exponent is this object, where G depends on time. And if we have this feedback system, K may also depend on time. Now, this solution has to be consistent with the growth rule. And one can show from the equation that I wrote here that this only works for one particular value of beta. It's not very hard to show, but I don't have so much time. You need beta equals what we call a critical value, 2 over 1 plus epsilon. And then this is actually a solution over time. This gives me an exponential solution over time, which grows homogeneously and scales. So it scales automatically. And let me show that with a numerical solution, and for a simple case where I put the degradation to 0. That's an artificial case, which is not, doesn't give the right values as compared to the wing, but it's illustrative. So I take my growth self-organization without any degradation. I still get exponential gradients because the G here plays the role of an effective degradation in this equation. And if I solve these equations numerically, choosing this value of beta, I indeed find concentration profiles that build up with time. There is a scaling now with length to the 2. I start with, if I start with initial conditions that are not well chosen, then I start with some inhomogeneous growth. But after a short time, the growth becomes homogeneous. And then sort of the color code here is the time. You know, the size of the tissue. Small tissues is blue, and big tissues is red. With small ones are inhomogeneous, and the large ones become homogeneous. And when we also find the time dependence of the growth, which you get analytically for this case, which decays with a power law. So this is different from what I showed you in experimental data, which, where the growth decayed exponentially. This growth decays with a power law. G goes like 1 over T, and the size of the system grows unboundedly to infinity with T to the 1/2. And that's a solution that we can check numerically. We see it's stable, but we also can find it analytically. Now we know from
Sorry, epsilon is a given in these numerical
this, yes, in this case, epsilon is a parameter.
Do you choose it to be so that beta is 0.8 or?
What? Yes, for example. I forgot what the choice, probably the choice was something like that here, yes.
Frank?
Yes?
Does this imply that if you, the model imply that if you transiently log growth, you could get closer to a steady state and then you would maybe never recover? Because then C dot over C would be a zero and you're frozen in a steady state.
If you're frozen in a steady state, then you would need to give some extra pulse of EVP to make it go again.
Is it possible to test experimentally by transiently blocking growth?
I think there are lots of interesting perturbations one can use to test that. Now, one reason why this example does not match the experimental data for the fly wing is that we have a good understanding of diffusion and degradation from various measurements. And in particular, we know that the time scale that we associate with effective degradation is 45 minutes, while this G is a much longer time scale. Now, in order to sort of have the right scale of the degradation rate that appears in this length scale, we cannot work with zero degradation rate. We have to introduce the K. And I should say, I forgot to mention that we have periodic scaling here. So we can now add this feature of regulation of K to the problem. So of course, one could also keep K constant as a parameter. What happens then is that a system grows to a finite size, but not with homogeneous growth. However, if one adjusts the K, that it varies with the tissue size, one can bring the system back into this regime where it generates homogeneous growth and scaling. And this is shown here. So here I would just assume that there's a mechanism that regulates K. And now I have a changed decay length. And I can operate with different V and K values to define lambda. Again, there's this critical point at which the system shows scaling and homogeneous growth. If I choose beta larger than this critical value, growth becomes inhomogeneous, and scaling is not exact, but it can still be approximative. It's also, growth may be only be weakly inhomogeneous. If we go to beta smaller, beta c, again, scaling is lost and growth is inhomogeneous. If I look at the time dependence of growth at this particular point, beta c, where I have scaling and homogeneous growth, I get again a power law decay, the growth rate, and unbounded growth. For larger beta, I get an exponential decay of the growth rate and growth arrest. And for beta smaller than critical value, I get unbounded growth. So there's at the critical point, the transition from bounded growth to unbounded growth. At the critical point, the system is has the feature of perfect scaling and homogeneity in growth, but it doesn't stop growing. So that's not the case the biological system wants to be in. But it may want to be in a case close to the critical point on the side where the system grows to a finite size. And since, as long as one is not far away from the critical point, one still has sort of an approximative homogeneity and approximative scaling property, which is what we have in the system. So we call this a critical point because if you plot the final size as a function of beta, it diverges at this point. And with this divergence of this tissue size, the tissue becomes self-similar during growth. It becomes really, so it reaches a point where it scales perfectly. And this perfect scaling is also associated with the fact that it cannot really stop growing because it's inconsistent with perfect scaling.
And this parameter epsilon is related to the shape of the wing in the end, the aspect ratio?
So the parameter epsilon, the growth anisotropy, would be, in the simplest picture, something like the active anisotropic stress in the picture, in the system. So if you have a fluid-like tissue which has cell rearrangements, you have an anisotropic active stress and growth, then you get anisotropic growth. And the anisotropy is set by the growth anisotropies and by the anisotropies of the stress.
Would you expect it to be time-dependent? Is complex as a wing?
We don't know. But in the simplest picture, we think of it as time-dependent, but...
Time-independent,
yes. So we don't have no need yet to make it time-dependent.
These results are all for constant source, new. The source,
yes.
BPP, so new,
yes.
Is assumed constant in time.
Yes, so in this model, I have taken the DBP source constant in time, but it has a width which grows. And to get perfect scaling, the source also has to scale. So it has to grow with the tissue. Now in practice, actually, a point I'll come to in a moment, in practice the source grows a bit less than the tissue grows, and that gives also an origin of moving away from the critical point. And there are different ways you can move away from criticality. One is not having the perfect 1 over L square dependence of the degradation rate. One is having beta a bit off of the critical value, and the third is having a source that doesn't grow perfectly with the tissue. But with this concept here, we can now, and this analytic arguments, we can now better understand also our vertex modeling calculations, which we did a few years ago with PAIR, where we have a vertex model that captures both DPP and Hedgehog, includes an expander mechanism to reduce, here we use a dilution mechanism to control the degradation rate, and we change the preferred area of cells with this growth rule. And this can account for the observed growth of the wing and also of the halter. And here I show you an example of the simulation of such a self-organized vertex model, where we have compartment boundaries, where we have cell division organized by this rule, and you see in regular cell divisions, the tissue also grows with a growth that slows down and then eventually stops. And this whole growth process is self-organized by the principles that I've outlined.
Periodic boundary conditions?
Here we have periodic boundary conditions, yes. That's why there are 2 of these lines.
Yeah.
And this is the sort of the corresponding pattern of chemical signals. These are the 2 compartments. We have in the posterior compartment hedgehog being produced, but not an interior one. These are the cells that then receive the hedgehog signal and start to produce DPP. The DPP is then shown in green. This is not a DPP profile. And the source grows here also because of the more and more cells receiving the hedgehog signal. We have an expander feedback so that the degradation rate changes with time, like 1 over L square. And this can account sort of for this basic feature of growth. Now, I mentioned, and this is probably my last comment, that the source width has to grow linearly with the system size. And if it doesn't grow linearly, I can introduce an exponent gamma to express the discrepancy. And only if gamma is 1 do I have the true scaling regime with the critical point. But if I allow gamma to be smaller, I still can have a transition between bounded and unbounded growth. And in the experiment and in our simulation, we are have a source that grows less quickly than the tissue as a whole, so we are somewhere down here. And so this is the estimates of where we find our experimental data in our simulations. We don't really know how to place. There's a significant error bar on this point. But we think we must be in the bounded growth region. And this simulation can actually account very well for this experimental data. So I think I've missed all my time. So I'd like to stop here and thank you all for your attention.
Maybe we can have just a couple questions and then come back 15 minutes to...
So what I'm trying to fit in this is your model is all based on 1 growth factor, so DP. We know that there are other factors, of course, that also influence the growth of the wing. So how would they fit into your model? Let's say the influence of insulin pathway or growth pathway.
That's an important, interesting question, difficult to answer. So what I'm showing so far is that this by itself provides these properties. And of course, it's not alone. I mentioned already that the maximal growth rate will depend on other factors. Then we have the signaling system, which has the output, which I alluded to, which has growth as an output. Find it shortly. And of course, this system can have other inputs from the sides. Already allude here that the Hippo pathway enters here. Yeah, so it's a hub for a number of signals to come in. And what I've been describing is a process of self-organization that focus on one pathway, one line of information processing. For example, also the mechanical feedbacks, they're certainly important. Yeah? They can contribute, in particular, they can stabilize the process that I've outlined. And then, of course, there's this issue about insulin and nutrition. So if the system cannot keep up with the growth it tends to have, how does it slow down everything or keep everything smaller? It's something we can discuss in this framework, but I don't have an answer to the question.
Okay, thank you.